Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala, New York podcast.
And I am Dave, your host. And contrary to the myth, I am not a relationship expert. Not only am I not a relationship expert, after listening to the talk that you're about to listen to right now, all my hopes of ever being a relationship expert are gone, dashed. It's over. It's done. Why? Well, you'll have to listen. You'll have to find out why. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for more information about all of our upcoming classes and retreats. Offerings for the summer, in particular, our summer week-long meditation retreat is happening the week of August 18th. Check it out on the homepage. If you've been thinking about it, come on, do it. Shastri Ethan Nickturn is the author of The Road Home, and he is the author of the forthcoming book, The Dharma of the Princess Bride, What the Coolest Fairy Tale of Our Time Can Teach Us About Buddhism and Relationships. It's coming out in September. Pre-order it now on Amazon. And this was a talk he gave a few weeks back at our weekly Dharma gathering in New York. Finally, the answer to the question, why am I not a relationship expert?
I've been trying to think if the path of meditation or the path of looking at our own mind, the path of awakening, as this is traditionally called, if there's any way it could start without a person saying, you know what, I need to spend some time with myself figuring out how I work. You know, like, just this isn't working. Meditation is, from the beginning of the Buddha's path, from the 2,500-year period, and maybe even before that, I think, that sort of refrain or that sort of insight, like, something is not working about the way I'm relating to myself. I don't know if there's another way to get to the meditation cushion, because honestly, there's so many other things you would do if it were working. You know what I'm saying? Like so many things. And so it's interesting to bring that to a tradition like Shambhala, where we, from the very beginning, kind of celebrate the human mind, celebrate our awakened potential, celebrate our basic goodness, because it seems that the path of meditation and awakening starts from a place of a person realizing they're really screwed up and broken. And I just want to say that's not our approach. Even if you're feeling that way. If you're feeling that way, you're in the right place. It's like 3 minutes in, Dad. You're in the right place. But the approach that we take here is that we all have to get to know ourselves better. But there's nothing fundamentally broken. We just need some tools and some support for looking at our own experience. And looking at our own experience without always having to bounce it off the world. You know, like, it's an interesting thing about our sense of self is so often, our sense of self is just like, I mean, I'm late Generation X, but, like, now your sense of self is just how many likes did you get today? So it'd be nice to sort of just remove ourselves from that and just say, like, how is my own experience? What is my own experience? Without having to talk to another person, without having to see what they think I'm going to say or what I'm going to look like, right? Just no ping-ponging back and forth of me with others. Just take my seat. Who is this person? And it's kind of terrifying, but it's necessary. And I think it's, you know, when we get over the idea that we're already supposed to be great at working with our own mind, which, to be honest, that's the number one obstacle we all have to get over, is the idea that, like, we're supposed to be able to have complete self-awareness the moment we sit down to meditate. It's just not, self-awareness is just not a big part of our culture. You know? Don't you think? I mean, the most internalized experience that people have is looking at this thing. And sometimes you could say, when you're walking down 6th Avenue and somebody's weaving and you're like, what is, like, pay attention. You're not the only person in the world. But the irony of that is they're not stuck in their own world then. They're actually paying attention to everybody else. The person we're not paying attention to when we're caught in our phone is ourself. So it's this weird, otherized self-absorption. So we all have to practice, like, making friends with ourselves. Who am I? What is it like to have a thought? That's like when you realize that there's an awareness that cannot be shared with anyone else, and in this space of awareness, a thought or emotion comes up, mixes with your mind, and then changes into something else. That's kind of a very profound realization. There are geniuses in the world who have not had that realization, that thoughts are arising in our own minds. And then there's all the other self-aware things we have to deal with in this path, which require us to be more present with ourselves, like awareness of impermanence, you know. That's an interesting one. To really come to terms with the fact that we are mortals. I mean, this is there's no news in this, right? That everybody here is in an impermanent vessel. But to actually sit with that and say, what does that mean for my experience as a being in the world? It's good to leave time to do that. So in a sense, I think the path of these teachings always starts with some kind of skillful retraction from an absorbed or otherized frame of relationships to say, who am I? What am I experiencing? What is my body and mind actually like when no one else is looking? So that's very powerful. And it's very humble to realize that I've been meditating probably 22 years regularly. Been teaching like 15, 16 years. Just getting to know myself a little bit. So that, I mean, that's the other thing about this is, like, he's been doing it for, like, at least 3 more years than that. No. 47 years? Is that right? 1970? Just getting to know yourself, or? So to realize that it really takes a lot of time with yourself to move along a path of awakening, you know? And there's lots of meditation being offered now, and it's great, and 98% of it is about stress reduction, which is great. I mean, we are not about stress amplification. But stress reduction is just the first step in a much deeper relationship with the mind that is not about an 8-week course. It's not about a weekend, although that could be the start of it. It's really about a regular, lifelong relationship with ourselves. So that's really the ground of these teachings. But, and I love the way my teacher says this in one of his books, Sakang Mipam Rinpoche. He says, when you sit to meditate, you realize, this is the way he says it, most of the thoughts that we take to be our own are actually social ceremonies grafted onto the mind. I love that. You really learn this as a person in postmodern American culture. Like, you really think you made up your profile to just realize how Don Drapered we all are, even if we're totally, you know, even if we're into the places that no one else goes, somebody else goes there. And we realize that to be alone with ourselves is to be constantly influenced by human and social relationships. And you also realize that you get off the cushion and people are everywhere. This is not a path of solipsism, right? They're like, we are not alone in the universe. That's the irony of the person, the me, who is distracted on Sixth Avenue. They so know they're not alone, and it's making them completely self-absorbed in that moment because they're trying to connect with others. It's a very ironic state, modern life. So realizing that the world is inhabited by so many others, we realize relationships have to be part of the path of awakening. That's the view of this tradition. The view of this tradition is there is no path of complete awakening, and this is just worth stating because this is not the view of every tradition of meditation. The view of this tradition is there is no path of complete awakening that does not require working with relationships as part of the path. Now, this is interesting because our Tibetan heritage of the Tibetan lineages that the holders of this lineage studied and passed down, there would be things like 3-year, 6-year, 12-year retreats in solitude. But the view, the idea was, if you want to wake up, you will have to deal with your relationship to other sentient beings because they are the ones who have completely created the thoughts, emotions, storylines, narratives, and views inhabiting your own consciousness. Right. The view of solitary awakening is a very libertarian view. I am actually fascinated by how much the Buddhist teachings, if you really look in the first 40 years, are influenced by American political narratives. They really are. Like the notion of like the solitary superhero who goes it alone, and then trying to fit the Buddha into that, like he left the world behind. He didn't need anybody. Not true. He had two meditation teachers. You know, he needed to get to know himself, but he was still in relationship, and he returned to the world in complete relationship to others. And he's the most solitary example of a master from our tradition. So I also think it's really good news when we realize we're in relationships because, and that they have to be part of the path, because we realize, you know, that actually love and desire, and especially desire, it's actually a really great thing. And I'm not just talking about romantic desire. Like, just think about, like, wanting to make a friend. One of my oldest friends from high school is also here. So got a lot of family stuff going on tonight. It's perfect. I didn't know any of you were coming until, like, 4 hours ago. right? You want to be friends with that person in high school. We're still in high school, by the way. That's the other... If I was going to start a school of Western psychology, that would be the name of it. We're still in high school. With some internal family systems thrown in or something like that. You want to be friends with somebody. You want to know what makes them tick. You want to hang out with this other person. Why, from an awakened state of mind, not from a grasping or fixated or desires a problem state of mind, does that happen? Why do you want to know another person? I think from an awakened standpoint, you realize it's great when there are multiple perspectives on reality. If you are just stuck in your own isolated chamber, you realize that you're stuck in your own, what we call, cocoon, ego, narrative, whatever word you want to use. And so it's great to say, what does the world look like to you? That's the same thing with love. I think more compassionate family relationships, you know, that moment you maybe asked your parents or an aunt or uncle or grandparents, like, so what's the world like? We spend a lot of time figuring out the world for me, but what's the world like for you, Mom? There's some longing to know a much more complex universe. And there's some unstuckness in that longing, right? The reason I wanted to write a book about relationships is I feel like there's a lot of myths about relationships and sort of mastering relationships, like people who are good at them, like some people, usually not me, is good at relationships. Has anybody ever had this thought? Like, other people are good at relationships, but I'm not, so I should just go back and meditate or go hiking or wander somewhere. Has anyone ever had a thought like you are the one who's bad at relationships? And I think for people who are interested in these sort of adopted Eastern spiritualities in the West, I think it kind of hits us from multiple sides. The first side is our pop culture and our kind of psychological pop culture, which has a thing called relationship experts. And then you have like rom-coms, you know, this notion of like perfect love. So you have all of these mythologies about idealized relatedness to others. Like, this is the way to communicate. These people must be masters at communication. These people must be masters at love. They know how to say the right thing. They know when it's time for a picnic or roses, etc. They know when to ask, you look sad. Like, so we have our kind of Western myths about that, and then we have our Eastern myths about that. Like, a Buddhist master must be great at relationships. Has anyone here studied the life story of the Buddha? He's 29 years old. He's in an arranged marriage. He has a 6-month-old son. He leaves in the middle of the night. This does not sound like a relationship expert to me. A deadbeat dad is what you would call this person, right? So it's interesting that there's certain versions of this story, because it's a very, obviously it's a lineage, we want to be very respectful, where like Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master's telling of the story, he says that basically that the Buddha Siddhartha had long conversations with his wife, who understood how unhappy he was, and she gave him permission to go on a spiritual quest. So he had understanding from his wife. But so, I'm sort of like, why tell the story that way? I mean, he's 29 years old. He's clearly in the middle of his Saturn's returns. He freaks out. He's human. right? Astrologers? Like, that's a more that's a story we can relate to a little bit more. So I was having a conversation with my dad about this notion of relationship expert. And that's the kind of premise of my book, is there's no such thing as a relationship expert. And I'm not saying there aren't great therapists to help other people with their relationships. I know many of them. I can recommend some to you if you need. I'm saying that the term relationship expert is an oxymoron. Because relationship, which is the nature of reality, means two or more subjectivities meeting. An expert is one person. So the term is an actual contradiction. It's interdependent individual, right? And so I was talking to my dad, and he was saying, so are you saying, do you remember this conversation? It's in the book, and I forgot to quote you, but I'm quoting you now. Are you saying that the act of relating to another person is the act of relinquishing your own expertise? And I said, yes, that is exactly what I'm trying to say. So how do we make relationships a practice? Realizing that a relationship is literally the meeting you've spent a little bit of time, maybe, or no time, or want to spend 12 years in a cave, getting to know your own mind. And now that mind, because it longs to know others and live in a bigger universe, connects with a completely different heart, mind, body. So how do we turn that into a practice? That's the beauty of this tradition, is that curiosity and openness and empathy, they are not outcomes. They're skills, they're tools that we use to relate to other people. And I really think that this is where the path gets interesting. When you realize that as you're getting to know your own mind and developing some tools like mindfulness, like self-compassion or loving kindness, insight, patience, discipline, these are great tools. As you're doing that, you're also getting to know other individuals and learning a few things. So I think it's really interesting to just take the approach, maybe everyone sucks at relationships. Maybe the Buddha was the first enlightened person willing to suck at relationships. And maybe that was the root of his awakening. And that leads us into really wanting to practice things that happen off the cushion, which are completely part of this path. Like, how do I listen? How do I express myself? How do I know when I'm listening too much? I'm being, as my friends like to say, mansplained to. You know that term? Maybe I listen too much. That there is such a thing as that. When is it time to express myself? When is it time to get out of this friendship? How do I work with a difficult person? How do I work with a person with different political views? How do I work with the fact that after every single meditation session, even if I get to go to like Vermont, which is, or Colorado or France, which in this tradition we have cool retreat centers in those places, they're in nature. You get to go away and just hear the birds who are not annoying at all because they're not your friends. You just get to project. That's the most beautiful part of animals, is we just get to project our own personas onto animals, right? And after every single retreat, we're going to come back, or every single session, we're going to come back and be confronted by relationships, by social ceremonies. So how do we make relationships part of our practice? And that's really, before I turn this over to discussion, that's how I wanted to end this, as with a very powerful statement that, according to the Shambhala tradition, in terms of our awakening and our progressing along the path of knowing ourselves better, suffering less, and helping other sentient beings, no one else can do it for you, and you can't do it alone. You cannot wake up alone. Nobody has ever woken up alone. That's the premise of this path. So I'm just throwing that out as a sort of, put that in your kombucha and sip it. So yeah, let's have some discussion so we can be a little bit more interrelated.
I was wondering if you could say a few words about forgiveness.
Yeah.
In regard to, in the context of what you've been speaking about.
Yeah, sure. Forgiveness for others or forgiveness for oneself? Yeah. Yeah, well, I think to follow the same premise, if the path always starts and has to ground itself in the idea that we have to get to know our own mind first, then I also think we have to notice how much we hold a grudge against ourselves for getting ourselves into this mess, whatever this mess is for you. And so the practice of forgiveness is some kind of energetic, I mean, it uses language, it can use embodied meditations, it can use visualizations, but it's some kind of energetic loosening of the ways that guilt and shame kind of clog our relationship to our own past, and just softening that into a learning space, you know? So I think, and then maybe forgiving others too. But the other thing I'll say about forgiving others is forgiving others is an energetic practice. It doesn't then mean you would go give the person what they want. You know, that's a lot of times people say, I can't forgive X, because then it would mean they were right or something. But those are two completely different explorations in this tradition. But yeah, self-forgiveness practice is powerful. Sometimes it's like the most intense practice, I find, just to realize, like, I did the best I could, and let me set an intention to shift next time. But yeah, I will say that what I found in my own experience and working with others, that the kind of shame and resentment that happens without forgiveness is the most stuck thing I've encountered. It can last a long time. You know, sometimes we have like 30-year-old stories. And according to the classic Buddhist teachings, you could literally have like 30 lifetime old stories. And I just picture another friend in high school being like, dude, let that shit go. But that's a practice. That's a practice. It takes place over time.
I'm not really sure the best way to ask this question, but I'll give it a shot. I've been accused in different in like romantic situations and like situations with my friends, and also just noticed it about myself that through my own quote-unquote maybe Buddhist way of looking at certain problems and like not hanging on to them mm-hmm. and not letting them be like thoughts that arise and yeah. eventually pass, mm-hmm. I can maybe have a lack of sympathy or compassion for someone who's hanging on to something that will eventually just pass. And I can see that, but it's a very real thing for them.
Yeah.
And sometimes it just ends up being maybe hurtful or mm-hmm. that I'm be like, you'll get over it.
Right, right.
And
right.
So I know that that's not really a Buddhist approach because it's not compassionate. So I guess...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It might be a Buddhist approach to what to think or how to frame, because the next thing from our tradition would be you actually do some kind of internal practice where you're actually wishing them freedom from the suffering or confusion.
Right.
So I know you'll get over it. Might be a good thing to think, like,
sure.
And here's a few cycles of sending and taking breath. Like, let me imagine myself breathing in the stuckness and breathing out the get over it-ness, which is not like this. It's more like a cool breeze going out. But probably not a Buddhist thing to say.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily say that. It's right. just kind of, it can be evident in yes. my attitude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that sounds like a good thing to practice with then. How do I actually, if I care about this person, how do I work on staying present? You know, having that thought, you know, a lot of times I notice with insights, there's like a jump to the punchline because you kind of know this is the way especially conceptual insights work, and they're right a lot of the time, but you sort of jump ahead. And I think it's very powerful when we're actually like willing to know how it's going to turn out. And then we're willing to go through the process. So it's like, just leave that, like, 2 years from now, this is going to be okay. Are you okay? You know, you can just practice being present even though you know how it's going to turn out. That's the way all of it's going to turn out, though.
Right.
That's the way Donald Trump's going to turn out. We'll get over it. You know?
Right.
That's not very... Me saying that, is I could tell, is helpful to zero people in this room, including myself. So then it's like, how do I work with the process most compassionately and skillfully towards myself and other sentient beings, knowing that that is the outcome of this? Yeah. Yeah. But... I think you know what you're working with. So, good. Have fun.
When we're in a situation, you have like 3 seconds to decide whether you are going to react, listen, tolerate, or whatever the many emotions or responses that are in your personality. When you're in a situation where you're being dealt with or spoken to in a way that you don't approve, let's just say someone has a temper,
yeah.
You know, it's easy to be cool when everything is cool, you know, mm-hmm. but it's hard to be cool when situation's not cool. And my question is, and if you could share any insight on the meter of when do you feel like you can tolerate something, and then when do you feel like, okay, I should not be spoken to in this way,
yeah.
And I should... First of all, now I'm disrespected, so it's not even about the issue. But then it's hard to know you know, where to go. You know, yeah. When something's on the stove, it's too hot, you just lower the flame. And you have like 3 seconds to decide. Can you share any insight on how to deal with a situation when it's really, really hot and you have like 3 seconds to decide and anything you do or say can make it blow up even
more?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. I think the 3 seconds part for me is the key part, right? And for me, that's also why meditation practice, because you get to just think about the person who makes the whole thing blow for you. It's a really good flight simulator because you have more than 3 seconds. And it's obviously easier to train when there's not that much in terms of consequence. I think you have to be willing to try different approaches. And that's, I think, why forgiveness is, you might... Have you ever had a 3-second situation where you're like, I handled it perfectly, I found the right balance of respecting myself, stopping the aggressive situation, and then, but the situation fell apart anyway? Has anyone ever had that moment where you're on the spot, you're in the heat of a conflict, and you're like, that was amazing what I just did. But the next day you get 10 angry emails anyway? So I think that's the advanced practice for sure. And I think the more we do the basic practice, the easier that will go. But I think to be able to have a kind of mantra or on the spot reminder for ourselves, like this is a hot situation, remember that the consequences go up in the hot situations, will help those 3 seconds to just learn, like just to say like, I'm triggered right now, or I'm angry right now, so that we know that we are in a bigger, a more dangerous zone. And I think also if you're feeling disrespected, if you can find a way to stop that without increasing the disrespect, you know, like if you're being lied to not just tell a different lie, you know, if somebody's making attacks at you, not to just make attacks back at them. But I think this is the other thing, like meditators need to get good at saying no to people who are trying to trample, because otherwise that's who runs the world, you know? That's a lot of what's wrong with the world right now, is we didn't say no. And so I think sometimes saying no, there's a practice in this tradition called wrathful compassion. But it's called wrathful compassion. It's not called like wrathful destroying somebody. But when it gets hot, your reactions are going to happen more quickly. You're in a different part of your nervous system. And so just at least knowing that it gets hot and that the consequences could be higher, I think, is important. But also, sometimes it's okay to be a... Don't you think it's okay to be a spiritual person and sometimes tell people how it is? Like, this cliche of, like, you know, while the world is falling apart and people are being oppressed, that we're supposed to be the ones, like, drinking tea on a leaf-blown pond. It's so created. That cliche is so clearly created by people who want to take over the world. Like, maybe the most attentive people who have practices, if I could just get them to sip tea while I'm abusing everyone, it's kind of a perfect plan, right? So throw wrathful compassion into your repertoire sometimes, but it is the most advanced practice, which means you'll need the most forgiveness, maybe knowing how to say sorry to yourself, sorry to others. But I don't know, what do you think?
I think the sorry is what you just said there.
Yeah.
Sorry to yourself, sorry to others. and to remind us that there is that wrathful compassion, because yes, this notion of, you know, meditators being so calm, they mistake the kindness for weakness, and you can get walked over, and it's going to be a continuous study, is how do I be wrathfully compassionate to to cool the fire and not make, not to trigger it more, but to cool the fire.
Exactly.
That's something to marinate in right
there. Yeah, that should always be our intention, to cool the fire. They do say that sometimes when they're, and this is a good analogy for wrathful compassion, when they're trying to stop a forest fire from spreading, they will skillfully set certain fires to stop the path from spreading further. So there is like an actual fighting fire with fire. It does exist. It's very rarely used, but it's only used by people who know what they're doing. Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Please, yeah, because I can't hear, and we can't hear.
Hi. This is my first time here.
What's your name?
Ivan.
Ivan. Ethan, nice to meet you.
Often confused with Ethan.
Really?
Say a Starbucks or something.
Yeah, I've never been confused with Ivan. Ian, probably not.
It doesn't work in reverse that way.
My other best friend in high school was named Ian. That was a nightmare.
That's the other one I get commonly called. So it's Ivan. But I'm new here, but I wanted to ask a question about a relationship with pain, our own bodies. I'm in a transition in life where I've recently had multiple surgeries, and, it's been torturous.
Yeah.
As if probably a bunch of the people in this room have had that experience in life, physical injuries and or sickness. Not the sympathy for someone else.
Right.
Oh, I'm so sorry that you're going through this. How can I be of service? But the own experience, the relationship with our own bodies and pain and sickness.
Chronic, right?
And what?
Chronic pain, are you talking about?
Chronic pain, yeah. Where you're like, bleep this, I'm over this, but it's not over.
Right.
And so I just wanted to hear some, I am new to this,
but
meditating in that stinks in a way.
Indeed.
So I just wanted to talk about that because I do have to transition positions, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
But without going off on that, I just wanted to ask, is there some input that you have on that?
Yeah. I mean, first, very simply, it's always okay to transition positions when you're meditating or to do walking meditation. If you know, or sit in a chair, or sit on different cushions, or lie down for a little while. So just making the transitions mindfully, but you know, it's you don't lose points for needing to shift your position. And then, you know, in conversations with people who've worked skillfully with meditation and chronic pain, couple things, and I'm not an expert in this, but I'll just share a couple things that people have shared with me or that working with students has worked. One is to really be skillful with your distractions, like to know when you need to take your mind off your body and what actually works to do that in a supportive way. You know, so again, you might say, like, isn't meditation about ending all distractions and being as present as we possibly can? Sure, ultimately, but there might have to be a path there that includes, like, I'm just going to sit for a short period of time or feel my body aching for a short period of time, and then I'm going to do something that takes the pain off or takes my mind off the pain, and then come back to being present. When you are being present with it, one thing that I've heard and has worked for me when I'm in pain is to do what's called noting practice, where you just, rather than just finding the breath, you actually place your attention on the sensation. And when there's a neutral sensation, you just say neutral. When there's a pleasant sensation, you say pleasant. in your mind silently. And when there's a painful sensation, you say, this is painful. Another thing you could work with is, if you're doing meditation practice, a sitting practice, is focusing on loving kindness practice. So you could bring your attention to the place that's painful and say, may this pain cease, or something like that. And there's actual techniques for phrases to use or breaths to use or things like that. But maybe the simplest advice is short periods of practice, and it's okay to change your posture. You know, don't make meditation add to the torture, because otherwise you're just not going to do it, you know. And I'm sure there's other people in this room who've worked with chronic pain and have worked through it, worked with it with their meditation practice, so maybe we could have more thoughts on that as well after, when we're hanging out with the Trader Joe's display.
I wanted to ask about Shambhala's take on attachment.
Yes.
I think there are several practices that talk about attachment and that being the root of kind of the ups and downs, and is kind of in contradiction to impermanence. And so just curious to hear what Shambhala's take on attachment is towards relationships.
Yeah, right. So attachment is a translation that was chosen at a certain point. It's a translation of several different words, and I find it to be a confusing translation. If you're referring to, so sometimes it's translated that the second noble truth, the first truth that the Buddha gave, is about suffering, or about eventually avoidable dissatisfaction. And the second noble truth is the cause of suffering, and sometimes in translation, which I don't think this is a very good translation, says the cause of suffering is attachment. So when you look at the word that the Buddha actually said, the word in the Pali, the early language, was tanha, which means something like thirst. But it doesn't just mean like, I'm thirsty, I want water or donuts or dates, you know. It means it's a fundamental thirst for reality to be different from how we experience it as being. It's like the way, I always like the way Sakyong Nyingpa Rinpoche says it. He says that it's the kind of thirst that has the quality of always wanting there to be another now. And so there's the words that I like in translation, my favorite is fixation. Because attachment, like if you study Western psychology, attachment theory, it's just a theory of safe and secure interrelatedness. Like, so attachment like can just mean you're connected to something, right? Do you agree that like, send me that attachment does not mean send me the cause of suffering? Send me this thing that's related to what we're talking about. It's connected, you know. Parents and children, they're attached in a certain way. Without that, none of these teachings would have ever evolved. The Buddha had it also very interesting to study his parental attachments. Mark Epstein's a modern Buddhist psychotherapist who talks about this in depth. Like, the Buddha lost his mother in childbirth. Clearly affected his whole path. Clearly had a very particular attachment style. That, if he had a different attachment style, his path may have looked significantly different. So fixation, a notion of like stuck. Our mind is stuck to a way we wish things were, or a way things used to be, or a way... others want them to be for us. And it's that stuckness that stops us from really perceiving what's happening in the present moment and finding satisfaction, finding some kind of celebration there. So anyway, the word is tanha. It was translated by early translators as attachment, but thirst is the literal translation, but even that's kind of weird. I like fixation. So if you get into the cause of suffering is fixating on a reality other than this one in the present moment. But that definitely comes up in relationships, right? That notion of a relationship being like, how can I control you? Which, let's be honest, this is also about relinquishing our expertise. A lot of the attempt to become a relationship expert is really to say, how can I master another person? Which gets really close to saying, like, how could I get the people who only do what I'm comfortable with? Which, why would you need other people then? That's the confusion in suffering, is our whole reason for wanting other people is we want other. We want a larger universe than just me. And then we spend all this time being like, how can I get you to play by my rules? So from that standpoint, we kind of brought it on ourselves, you know. But we learned it from other people, so. Does that help? Attachment, yeah. Fixation? Okay. I think this is a good stopping point. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Shastri Ethan Nickturn, author of the forthcoming book, The Dharma of the Princess Bride. Pre-order it now. Coming out in September. Yeah, it's okay that I'm not a relationship expert. I'm gonna devote my time to some other hobbies. Maybe I'll start collecting stamps or learn another instrument. Who knows? Visit us at ny.chambala.org. for more information about upcoming classes and retreats. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look it up. But if you are in the New York City area, come say hi. Our weekly Dharma gathering happens every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks in person, live, with the teachers in front of you. You can see them. You can touch them. You can smell them. Podcast with you later.